Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind. Guru, Deity, Protector, Part 9.
Well, clearly you've discriminated between the two of them. What's the difference?
I was just like being present. So I went back to the breath to sort of come back from daydreaming, kind of stop wandering. So I wasn't actually doing anything with my body, but I was doing a lot of things in my head. Making lists, you know, remodeling my house, cleaning up the garage, that kind of thing.
You've been, I thought you were meant to be doing nothing.
Right. So then I go to breathing. I mean, is that a good way to kind of come back? I didn't quite know how to come back.
Yeah. What's the qualitative difference in this, for lack of a better term, state of mind between zoning out and being present, even when you're using the breathing? What's the qualitative difference in your experience?
Sorry.
Yeah. And that's the differentiation. It's all about clarity.
Make sure it points to you somewhere, because the last time it didn't, and it didn't pick up anything. Not that it makes any difference, this has been working fine.
Okay. So is that good like that?
Yeah, it's good.
It just depends which way the cloth falls, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Susan.
When I was doing this, I felt pretty blissed out. And then an irritating thought came in, and I crashed really hard, and it took over, and I knew what I was supposed to do, and I tried to do it.
What were you supposed to do?
Try to return to attention. And
that didn't work.
Okay.
The thought crashed and kept crashing. And
it was too powerful, and I thought, okay, experience it fully.
Did you experience it fully?
No.
Guess you should follow your own instructions.
Is that really all it is?
Is that an effective method to work? Yes. Now, one of the things about sky gazing, it's an energy transformation exercise as well. And you're transforming things into clarity. That's part of its purpose. The trick, or the danger, is the energy transformation practices. Is that if you don't stay in attention, guess what happens to all of that energy?
Yeah,
ran into that annoying thought.
Yeah, it was so minor that it became huge.
Yeah. You know, in a different way, this is why it's extremely important not to have someone who's emotionally unstable in a retreat such as this. Because
all of the energy that develops in the retreat will, if one person isn't unable to hold it, will pour into that dysfunction in the person. The consequence of that is that everybody experiences a drop in energy, so it's harmful to the retreat. But that person's neurosis or whatever is also magnified because they've got 20, 30, 50, 100 people's energy pouring into it. And that's what actually induces psychotic breaks. It's not that the person is that fragile, it's just that in that environment, all of that energy is kind of, the same thing happens within. So, what the option that's available to you is you experience it completely. In the body, all of the emotions connected, I'm sure there were a few, and you're just right in it.
I think I gave up too quickly because it did feel like there was so much energy when I was experiencing that I couldn't work up the energy to the intention of it.
How much energy does it take?
It felt like it would take a lot.
Yes, part of the story. It actually takes none. It takes no effort at all to drop into whatever you're experiencing right now. But the story is, oh, this is going to be really hard. It's going to be really painful. It's going to be terrible. You're going to have to work up to this. Right?
Where are you all saying it takes a certain level of attention to be an effort?
Difference between a level of attention and an effort. The practices that we have been doing, as everybody here can say, kicks up a certain level of emotional reactivity. Just checking to make sure that was everybody, but it is. And one of the reasons why I said people have to have a certain amount of experience is so that they have a capacity and attention that they can actually experience that level of reactivity. Before?
Mm-hmm.
The effort that involves is just the decision to do so.
Once the attention is in place.
Yeah. And that's why one practices meditation, is to build up that capacity of attention. So there's a difference between developing the capacity of attention and just experiencing what it is. If there isn't that capacity of attention, then the open to the experience of what is, they just get swamped and thrown into reactivity. Because the attention is at a lower level, what is just takes over. What's arising just takes over. Fine? Okay.
I have a question about protectors. When you were, teaching about it yesterday, most of the images you were using were pretty violent and warlike and things like that. But are there other kinds of protectors that kind of protector isn't? I haven't been able to get in touch with it so far, so I'm just wondering if there are other forms of protector.
Any
with wings?
Pardon? What?
Any with wings?
You don't want to meet the ones with wings. Yeah, well, I'm a bit short on nicer. The there are at least two things going on here. One is all of that very dark imagery, which goes back to those dark unspoken roots in our psyche, or however you want to talk about it. And the other is, and this has more to do with the wrathful meaning of these figures, this is not anger, it's not aggression, it is energy. And as I mentioned yesterday, you have the four kinds of activity. The protectors just go out and do it. Pacification, enrichment, magnetization, and destruction. And I've been trying to remember a story about a Chinese emperor who was completely undone because he sent his general off to take care of a problem. And the general ended up making peace with the opposing party, because the general got out there, saw what the situation was, and did what was called for. I can't remember whether it was the emperor or the general that lost his head, but one of them did. But another example, this is from a very good Tai Chi teacher called Abraham Liu. I think he was up in the Bay Area. And he, in a book called There Are No Secrets, right at the end of this, of the book, he describes that he was well on in his Tai Chi training and quite confident in his ability to meet situations. And he saw, he was on the subway in New York, and a drunk was accosting a young woman. And he thought, oh, well, I can step in and do something here. And he was just going to move in when this elderly Japanese man slipped in front of him and started engaging the drunk in a conversation. And the drunk became so entranced with the conversation he was having with the Japanese gentleman that he forgot about the young woman completely. And everyone went, oh, pacification. So when you may have the experience when you invoke the protectors, say, okay, go to work. And they come down and say, what's your problem? There's nothing wrong here. Now you've got another situation. It's all in your head. There's no problem. They can come back for that. You follow? Yeah. Or say, oh, we took care of it. You didn't do anything. Yes, we did. But you didn't do what I wanted. That's tough shit. You have no control. You have no control about how they address it. It's very important.
What's enrichment?
Bribery. Putting more emotional feeling into a conflict. A number of lawsuits around sexual abuse, for instance. The victim wants something very explicit, and it actually doesn't cost any money. They want an apology. A lot of people go to court. So they don't have, they pay millions of dollars, so they don't have to make an apology. Mm-hmm. And
he did make it.
Yeah. But that's enrichment. You work it out fine. You may need a little more than would ordinarily be the case. Training is another form of enrichment. We bring in outside resources. That's the, we bring in outright outside resources to resolve the situation. That's the characteristic of enrichment.
It doesn't bring time, isn't it? The protective one, or softer protector.
Oh, but she's not so soft. Yeah, but very definitely. I mean, she has the same kind of thing.
Mm.
And and she has pacification, enrichment, and destruction. She doesn't bother with magnetization. You know, if it's not working out, that's it. Which is why she's green, because that's white, yellow, and blue. Those are the colors. So she's a little on the impatient side. A little different from white tower.
According to Snowgirl, she was like actually the first tantric deity in any of the rituals through doctrine, Earth Mother.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Very old rules. Of course, that's where Kali comes from, the first real deity. Pardon?
Yeah, black.
Yeah. Okay. May I borrow one of these? Okay. I'm not going to get everything done. This is a story about, you know, that's one way to see it. Maybe you have other ways. Once upon a time, there was a merchant named Abdul Malik. He was known as the good man of Khorasan because from his immense fortune, he used to give charity and hold feasts for the poor. But one day it occurred to him that he was simply giving away some of what he had, and that the pleasure which he attained through his generosity was far in excess of what it really cost him to sacrifice what was, after all, such a small proportion of his wealth. As soon as this thought entered his mind, he decided to give away every penny for the good of mankind, and he did so. No sooner had he divested himself of all his possessions, resigned to face whatever events life might have in store for him, Abdul Malik saw, during his meditation hour, a strange figure seemed to rise from the floor of his room. A man was taking shape before his very eyes, dressed in the patchwork robe of the mysterious dervish. "O Abdul Malik, generous man of Khorasan," intoned the apparition, "I am your real self, which has now become almost real to you because you have done something really charitable, measured against which your previous record of goodness is as nothing. Because of this, and because you are able to part with your fortune without feeling personal satisfaction, I am rewarding you from the real source of reward. In future, I will appear before you in this way every day. You will strike me, and I will turn into gold. You will be able to take from this golden image as much as you may wish. Do not fear that you will harm me, because whatever you take will be replaced from the source of all endowments." So saying, he disappeared. The very next morning, a friend named Bey Akal was sitting with Abdul Malik when the dervish specter began to manifest itself. Abdul Malik struck it with a stick, and the figure fell to the ground, transformed into gold. He took part of it for himself and gave some of the gold to his guest. Now Bey Akal not knowing what had gone before, started to think how he could perform a similar wonder. He knew that dervishes had strange powers and concluded that it was only necessary to beat them to obtain gold. So he arranged for a feast to be held to which every dervish who heard of it could come and eat his fill. When they had all eaten well, Beakal took up an iron bar and thrashed every dervish within reach until they lay battered and broken on the ground. Those dervishes, who were unharmed, seized Beakal and took him to the judge. They stated their case and produced the wounded dervishes as evidence. Beakal related what had happened at Abdul Malik's house and explained his reasons for trying to reproduce the trick. Abdul Malik was called, and on the way to the court, his golden self whispered to him what to say. "May it please the court," he said, "this man seems to me to be insane, or to be trying to cover up some penchant for assaulting people without cause. I do not know him, for this story does not correspond with my own experiences in my house." Beakal was therefore placed for a time in the lunatic asylum until he became more calm. The dervishes recovered almost at once through some science known to themselves. And nobody believed that such an astonishing thing as a man who becomes a golden statue, and daily at that, could ever take place. For many another year, until he was gathered to his forefathers, Abdul Malik continued to break the image which was himself, and to distribute its treasure, which was himself, to those whom he could not help in any other way than material. This one is about protectors. Maybe. There is a proverb that the opposition of the man of knowledge is better than the support of the fool. A horseman, from his point of vantage, saw a poisonous snake slip down the throat of a sleeping man. The horseman realized that if the man were allowed to sleep, the venom would surely kill him. Accordingly, he lashed the sleeper until he was awake. Having no time to lose, he forced this man to a place where there were a number of rotten apples lying upon the ground and made him eat them. Then he made him drink large gulps of water from a stream. All the while, the other man was trying to get away, crying, "What have I done, you enemy of humanity? Why should you abuse me in this way?" Finally, when he was near to exhaustion and dusk was falling, the man fell to the ground and vomited out the apples, the water, and the snake. When he saw what had come out of him, he realized what had happened and begged the forgiveness of the horseman. The man who was saved said, "If you had told me, I would have accepted your treatment with good grace." The horseman answered, "If I had told you, you would not have believed, or you would have been paralyzed by fright, or run away, or gone to sleep again, seeking forgetfulness, and there would not have been time." Didn't have time to find the one about the girl, but... Now, as you are aware, what we've been working with didn't arise out of thin air. This whole approach to practice has evolved over centuries. And been shaped, enriched, refined by the experiences of numerous extraordinary individuals. If I can, I want to go over two aspects of this. The first, we find starting bottom of page 10. The verses with Padmakara, Yeshe Tsogal, Kama and Terma lineages, culminating in Trima Rozer, more widely known as Longchenpa, all refer to the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. This tradition started with the invitation Shantarakshita, I think, by one of the Western Tibetan kings in the 8th century. And Padmasambhava, I think, was the third Indian master to be invited because there were problems. And Padmasambhava's role is such that for most Tibetans he became a figure as important or more important than Buddha Shakyamuni, because this is the person who really opened the doors for the Dharma in Tibet. Student, a consort of his, Yeshe Tsogal, I think was originally one Chinese princess. Am I right on that? She was a Tibetan princess? Okay. Became a very highly regarded teacher in her own right. And actually from both of them came lines of transmission. And Kama refers to lines of transmission that are traced back to Guru Padmasambhava or to India. And Terma refers to teachings that have been revealed at various points in time by particular teachers known as treasure revealers, Tertans, when the time and conditions have been appropriate. But there are vast collections of these lineages put together in the 19th century, actually, to preserve them. Some of you may recall a teaching I gave, I think it's here, on how to work with reactive emotions from a Dzogchen point of view. It was several years ago.
Yeah.
That was such a Terma. And but there are hundreds and thousands of them. And I talked a little bit about Longchenpa or Trime Odzer, who is regarded as codifying the many disparate elements of the Nyingma tradition.
What century?
13th, 14th, as far as I remember. Yeah, I think the dates are in the footnote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 47.
Yeah, 1308 to 1364. 14th century.
Ken?
Yes?
Can I ask a question about the Termas? Are they still finding new ones? Because supposedly they have been, you know, hidden and that.
Yeah. There was Chokchu Dechen Lingpa. It was a 19th century Tertan. And quite an extraordinary figure. And then Dujin Rinpoche, who was died, when did he die? Yeah. In the 80s? Yeah, or the early 90s, somewhere around there. But he was a contemporary teacher. I met him a couple of times. But he was a Tertan, and it was a huge cycle of teachings, which are widely practiced now, which he discovered and just kind of wrote them all down. So yes, it's still going on. After this initial wave of Buddhism, the aristocracy, the change in the monarchy, and in the 10th century, Buddhism is subject to a period of vicious persecution, and many of the aristocracy tried to drive it out of Tibet completely. So a lot of teachings went underground, and eventually that king actually was assassinated. And then Buddhism is in kind of shambles. Some streams continued on, but there's a lot of confusion. So a lot of other teachers, members of the aristocracy and some of the kings, invited a Indian masters, and many people journeyed to India, and this is in the 11th century. Of these, one of the most notable was Atisha, who was, you know, pretty comparable to the Pope of Buddhism in India at that time. Very, very high ranking teacher and master. And he committed a faux pas, shall we say, in Bodh Gaya. And he had a very close relationship with Tara. And whenever he just thought of Tara, and she just appeared in front of him. They would converse like two people. But after this faux pas, he prayed to Tara, and no Tara. So he performed a lot of offerings and did a whole bunch of confession. She appeared, but her back was turned. You know, did I do something wrong? She said, yep. What's the karma? You'll be born as a worm that encircles the world 7 times and be pecked to death every day for 500 million years. Is there an alternative? Yes. Go to Tibet. I'll take the worm. About that time, Rinchen Zangpo showed up, and so Atisha agreed to go to Tibet. And Atisha did a great deal to revitalize, and but this comes at a 200 or 300 years later than the original wave. So Buddhism from this era, the teachings from this era, have a very different flavor from the original, from the Nyingma tradition. Nyingma means the old ones. And Atisha's coming to Tibet is generally regarded as the beginning of the new school of translation. Marpa was a Tibetan landowner of ferociously bad temper who journeyed frequently to India, and among his many teachers was the great master Naropa. And he brought back an esoteric tradition, the six yogas of Naropa and the Nidams. His main disciple was Milarepa, who is one of the great folk heroes of Tibetan tradition, living in the mountain vastness most of his life. He had many disciples, of which the most prominent was Dakpo Rinpoche, also known as Gampopa. And these three, Marpa, Mula, and Dakpo, are taken as the patriarchs or the founders of the Kagyu schools of Buddhism. Oh, sorry, what Atisha gave rise to became known as the Kadampa school. Dharma Rinpoche had four principal disciples. And one of them, his name is Pama Drupa. One of them was Pama Drupa, another one was Karmapa. The first Karmapa, Dusan Chenpa. And a whole line of transmission became associated with the Karmapa. It became known as the Kama Kagyu. And Pama Drupa gave rise to eight separate lineages. He's a great teacher, he had eight great disciples. And so when you read down in the next verse, you have the four great and eight lesser lineages, the four, and you see this also in the Vajradharaka, these are four Kagyu lineages coming from Gampopa, and then the eight minor ones coming from Pama Drupa. And some of those are still extant today. The Kama Kagyu, of course, is extant, as well as the Drupa Kagyu, which is one of the lesser, but it became very important, the Trikong. And there's some very good treatment teachers in the States.
Is the Shangpa tradition part of the Kagyu tradition?
No.
No.
And that's what I'm coming to. Another whole line of transmission was the Sakya, beginning with Sakya Kunga Nyingpo. This was another person who studied with Indian masters, took the made the journey to India, brought back a whole another set of teachings. That became a whole another line and became one of the four major schools of Tibet. And then on the next page you find the Shangpa. Well, actually, I should go back. At this point you have the four major traditions. You have the Kadampa, which eventually became the Gelugpa after a bunch of permutations, the Nyingma, the Kagyu, and the Sakya. The Shangpa line of transmission also goes back to, and I'm going to say a bit more about the Shangpa in a moment, to an Indian teacher called, a Tibetan teacher called Trungpa Nagyur. And Tongtong Gyalpo, who is 16th, 17th century teacher, was one of the great Shangpa masters, great visionary. The Chenrei Zi Sadhana that we did last year, that particular practice comes from Tongtong Gyalpo. It was received in a vision from Chenrei Zi. He had a lot of visions, this guy. Quite extraordinary.
Is he in that picture?
Yes, he is, actually. But let me come to that.
Okay.
Then you have Padampa Sungjae, who is another Indian master who came to Tibet about the same time. He was a contemporary of Notarupa. They actually met, as did Martha and Atisha. One of his principal students, a person he had a great deal of collaboration with, was Lakshi Droma. And the two of them gave rise to two separate traditions, one called the Shijae, that's associated with Padampa Sungjae, which means the pacifying or calming tradition, and the other, of course, Chut, which takes its name from the Diamond Sutra. It's associated with Lakshi Droma, Lakshi Bhakti. Her biography has been translated by a colleague of Dan's, Sarah Harding. Done a very, very thorough job on it. It's available as Machik's complete explanation. It's wonderful because there's a great deal of really great teaching in it, but it also gives you a pretty good flavor of what it was like being a teacher, a student and a teacher in Tibet at that time. Another line of transmission, Dolpo Sungjae, this is the Kala Chakra. I don't know a lot about the Kala Chakra, something that's not had a lot of resonance for me, but for many people, it's something that just captures them completely. It was the last major tantra to be transmitted from India to Tibet, and in a certain sense represents the culmination of Indian Buddhist tantra. Vast body of learning invested in it. Taranatha is a 17th century teacher who is also lineage holder of the Shangpa and the Jonangpa, which at Taranatha's time was completely suppressed because of political machinations. This is around the time of the when the fifth Dalai Lama was coming into power. And the consequence of that is that all of the Jonangpa texts, including all of the Shangpa texts, were locked up, and nobody had access to them for 400 years. So the Shangpa tradition survived that period only by being transmitted through mountain yogis, totally out of the purview of the Tibetan, the major Tibetan institutions. Jamya, the next three verses, I think, I'm not positive, all refer to Jamyang Chintse Wangpo, who was one of the great 19th century teachers and one of Tongtrul's primary teachers. And then the next four verses refer to Tongtrul. You get a name when you become a monk, you get a name when you become a bodhisattva, you get a name when you take Vajrayana initiation, you get a name when you become a certain scholar of a certain level, and that's why you have all of these different names. And in this prayer, Tongtrul is acknowledging the sources of teaching which he had the close connection with and which spoke to him very powerfully. So he was raised initially in a Nyingma monastery. The Kagyu snatched him up, and to stop the Gelugpa snatching them, they recognized him as a tukul, because there was an unspoken rule that if they recognized as tukul, they couldn't be snatched up. Politics, you know. And he had very deep Nyingma roots with his, along with his association with Chintse Wangpo, who was really, but the two of them, and this really comes from Chintse Wangpo, were very, very concerned about the extreme sectarianism which had created the condition where people of other of different traditions really didn't speak with each other anymore. And that's very sad. And so they wanted to revive at least a bit of respect among the traditions. And they worked very, very hard at this in the 19th century in eastern Tibet. And Kala Rinpoche, my own teacher, who is regarded as an incarnation of Jangdrung Khonthul, continued this approach in his own life. Very ardently, and it's something that I think is very, very important. It's one of the reasons why I haven't studied a lot in other traditions. I'm very I've taken teachings, significant teachings in both the Kama Kagyu and the Shangpa Kagyu, but also in Nyingma. And Dajun Rinpoche, who's a Sakya teacher, is also one of my teachers. One of the reasons why I feel this is particularly important now is that in the last 20 years there have been what I think can be described as major disruptions, four major disruptions that I know of personally in the transmission of knowledge from one generation to another, because it was going through a lineage and just down one narrow line. The most recent, which affects Dan and me quite personally, is that Kala Rinpoche's spiritual heir, Boka Rinpoche, died unexpectedly of a heart attack about 2 months ago. And this is before he had transmitted the, at least we suspect, it's before he transmitted the whole Shankar's teachings to the new Kala Rinpoche. So this represents a very significant disruption, and you know, it's very sad. I've come to the conclusion from this that the lineage model of transmission is extremely fragile. And it wasn't always this way in Tibet. Back in the time of Gampopa and Rangjin Dorje and these earlier people, there's a tremendous amount of interaction. And this is what Kongpol and Chense Wangpo were trying to reignite. So it's one of the reasons why I've never been a proprietary teacher. That is, some teachers say, if you study with me, you can only study with me. But it's very helpful to absorb different perspectives from other traditions and learn. And it also brings more robustness and vitality to what has passed from generation to generation, because you have this enrichment that goes on. So that's something that I encourage people to do. That being said, at a certain point in your practice, you have to go deep into one thing, because you really need to go deep. And if you constantly move around, you're always leaving yourself an escape hatch. So, you know, there's some balancing to do. Now, the next thing I want to do is to talk a little bit about the Shankar lineage.
What were the other three?
Other three? Oh, well, there's the whole thing around the Karmapa. And then there's the disruption that took place with the Zermong tradition and the Trinko Rinpoche. And what's the fourth one? And Jonathan Control, who is another Kaiju teacher who was unexpectedly killed in 19. In fact, I was here when I received the news for that. It was 1992. And I think it was Sokin came out to tell me that Control had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in a car. He was killed in a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a particular relationship with that that Jensen Conklin. So that made me very sad. Now, this page here. Page 8. In the center is Chungpo Naoja, who was originally a Dzogchen master. The Dzogchen people will hate this, but it didn't work for him. Actually, he was originally a Bonpo master. And that didn't work for him, so he did Dzogchen. And that didn't work for him. So at the age of 57, which is a ripe old age for a Tibetan back in the 11th century, he went to India and studied with, tradition says, 150 different teachers, but the four most important, or actually the two most important, are Nigama, who is the figure at the very top left, and Sukha City, who's the figure at the very top right. It's both women.
Who's top left?
Niguma. N-I-G-U-M-A.
Can you spell his name, please?
Pardon?
Can you spell his name, please?
Chungpo Naoja? K-H-Y-U-N-G hyphen P-O. N-A-L, it's on page 28 in footnote 23.
Mm-hmm.
It
is.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Did he live 255?
Is that
it? No, I don't remember. I don't think so.
In the back it says that he lived from 900 to 1100 or something.
Oh, I think there must be a typo there.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, I hadn't noticed that. It's difficult to tell sometimes because the Tibetan calendar was a 60-year cycle, and there wasn't much way to distinguish things that was just 60 years apart. So. But 984, that looks like too early a date for him to have been born. Well, no, it's hard to say. Anyway, Nigama and Sukhasiddhi were his two main gurus, and then you see on either side of Vajradhara, who's the blue figure, two other teachers there, Maitrepa and Rahula, who are two other Indian teachers that were important gurus. And then around him are his own teachers, his own students, or his lineage that came from him. Chergampa and Mochokpa, and so forth. Immediately underneath Chumpa Naudra is Tongtong Drapa, who is shown in his usual iconography as holding the vase of long life. He had a very close connection with Amitabha, the Buddha of long life. And his other hand, the ultimate iron chain, which he had this extraordinary ability to smelt iron into steel, long before steel had been discovered. And he built bridges out of it. It lasted into the 20th century. It's now, if you go down and you see the figure, I think the figure directly below Tongtong Drapa, I think that's Taranatha, but I have my original version of this, I can read the Tibetan inscription. But the figure immediately to the right, the one with the mustache, if you can just make it out, this is Kalarindisha. Yeah, there's one photograph of him, and he's like an RAF officer.
Dashing,
yeah. I mean, Jobson used to say that was Rinpoche's secretary. He said that Rinpoche was so handsome that when he walked down the street, the woman would faint. So anyway, this is the Shangpa tradition, and it's a different line of transmission than the Kagyu transmissions which come through Marpa, Nula, and Gampopa. And it's very special, many many ways. It's been the secret practice of many of the great figures of Tibetan Buddhism. And Jangan Kontrol the Great, who wrote the prayer that we use, it was one of his special lineages. And having been hauled out of one three-year retreat to teach the, it would have been the 14th Kamapa, grammar, and then Siddha Rinpoche showed up and said, I hate to do this, but you're the best grammarian. Kontra was all up about 22 at the time. He said, you're the best grammarian around, so can you teach him, please? Thank you. Called him out a three-year retreat, so much for spiritual progress. But he did extract the promise. He says, I get to do another one. So in his late 20s, early 30s, Siddha Rinpoche and Kontrol went wandering in the mountains to looking for an old retreat site. This is Rinchen Trop, was Kamal Soleng. And they got totally lost because it was mist and fog. And then this bird landed in front of them. It's odd. And they started to approach the bird, and it flew about 50 yards away. They had almost lost it in the mist. And they just kept following the bird, and it led them right to the retreat site that they were looking for. And there's all the rooms and everything. So Kontrol fixed it up and started the three-year retreat that he'd got permission to do. And in the middle of this, this yogin shows up. He says, I'm here to give you these teachings. And he gave him the whole Shankar transmission. Not the whole thing. He just gave him a whole bunch of stuff, just the really core stuff on the six yogas. And said, bye. after one. And he started to practice it. Found it very fruitful. A year later, Yogan shows up again and says, here's the rest of it. And then disappeared. But that is one of Pontrell's very close to Pontrell's heart. And he wrote a lot of the text. As I said, all of these texts were locked up. So after he'd done all of this, he went to central Tibet and persuaded the person who was in charge of the warehouse. Well, the Jhonangpas, they've been out of business for 400 years. Do you think you could release the text now? And no. Well, could you let me run one copy off the woodblocks? Okay. So Contral ran one copy off the woodblocks. Of course, all of the transmissions have been broken, so they've been locked up for 400 years. And Contral read them and studied them and then rewrote them all and started new modern transmissions. A very important figure for us.
Are these, any of these practices, anything we did this weekend directly related to that?
Well, if you look on page 25, you see at the bottom, the very last line. Written by Taranatha, and many of the texts, A Great Path of Awakening was written by Contral, and many of the texts that we studied during the retreat.
I agree with you that this, you know, in a really tragic example of what are your thoughts on another means of transmission? This is really.
Oh, I think teachings have to be given much more liberally, so that they and they go out. They don't try to keep the silos.
Mm.
I think that's what's important. I think it's the only way to do it.
So, you feel as if real teachings from the Shangpa have been lost because of this?
Well, I knew they'd been lost back in the 19th century. Contral, and one of the practices in. That I feel a special connection with is the five tantric deities, which is another one of the pictures in here. And there are five deities, and you do all of them simultaneously, but once upon a time, there were particular visualizations connected with each deity. And I was reading a list of Contral's, a recording of one of Contral's question and answer periods back in the 19th century. I had to write all the stuff down. And, actually, it's in his bunk. And somebody asked him a question about differences in the visualizations for these five deities in the Shankara tradition. And Contral says, oh, yeah, I wrote that down on a list so I wouldn't forget, but I can't remember where I put it. So it's gone. That was 100 years ago. How much of this stuff, how much stuff's been lost over the centuries? I mean, in the Shangpa tradition, we have this Juma Longchen. It's this really, really weird text. And I can get just enough out of it to understand that this was some very strange method of working with the four immeasurables using energy transformation techniques. But all we have now is the text. Don't have any of the instructions. Yeah. I'd be really interested in that. That was there. I had most, but that was lost. So yeah, things have been lost. Lots. Okay, Deborah?
Most of these methods of working have come through. You mentioned one of the teachers who was a great visionary.
Yeah, Tong Tong Jiapa.
And that's how a lot of them. So when you have a hint of something that was lost in that way, where does it come back? I mean, does somebody have a vision again, or does somebody
Well, yeah,
there's been enough exchange of teachings.
It all comes out of your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes back to that basic principle. Whatever works. Mm-hmm. And new stuff will come up. Don't know what form it will take. It'll be there.
Can I say something about the care of the interior?
Yeah, thank you. One thing I've been quite remiss on, which caused a few people a little embarrassment now and then. Want to say anything?
I was at a function at a monastery in July, and there were materials that we could have, and then there was a discussion, and I put it under my chair, and I was like descended upon by several nuns, and so I didn't know that I was doing such a bad thing.
The Tibetan tradition, originally the printed word, because the printed word was developed solely for the expression of Dharma in Tibet originally, was held in great veneration. So, you know, when I took refuge, we were told, you know, you never desecrate anything that's printed, which, you know, Western is totally absurd. You know, you've got candy wrappers flying around all over the place. That there is tremendous veneration for the recording of the Dharma, and this is the principal method of recording. So it would never be put on the floor, you'd never step over it, never carry it under your arm, and never put food on top of it, so forth. And those are very, very deep elements of Tibetan culture and protocol. Many of them have been adopted by Westerners who've been trained in those traditions. Many years ago I came up here to do a sesshin and had all the chant booklets, and after we'd finished the chants I was wondering what to do with them, and everybody slipped them under their zafu. So, you know, these are very precious words, and one certainly can, an aspect of our practice is to treat these and other booklets which contain teaching, which is the traditional Tibetan form booklets, with respect. What constitutes respect, unfortunately, varies tremendously from culture to culture. So be sensitive to this. Do what you can.
It reminds me, at the very beginning of the retreat, you were talking about this thing of being weird. And I wondered, you know, connected to transformation, and I wondered if that was the root of word.
No, I think so. Okay. I can check etymologically. Anyway, we need to close because we're over. Let's do the Vajradhara prayer and protection.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.